I'd like to introduce Dr. Laurel Berman, who is, one, the ATSDR's National Brownfields Coordinator, but also the very active Brownfields person in the EPA Region 5 Chicago office.
Thank you. How many people here are from Michigan? Anybody? And so we have two people from the city of Detroit. Good. Our action model, of course, I am housed in Region 5 in Chicago, but this is a national program, so we're starting to work outside of Region 5. One of the reasons we have so many sites in Region 5, or so many projects, is because we have a disproportionate number of brownfields and land reuse sites, and probably because we're the industrial belt of the Midwest. So don't worry, we are starting projects in Region 9 here, which California is included in Region 9. We have one in Saipan, we're starting one in Phoenix. Also want to mention, there are some health department folks here. ATSDR just funded 7 health departments across the country to do community-based redevelopment public health projects. Nothing to disclose. I want to credit my fellow steering committee members. We can't do this alone. There's 2 of us funded to work on brownfields for the entire country, but we have a lot of volunteers. Tara Summers is listed in the program. She was going to give this presentation. Tara has 2 young children and is fostering her 2nd foster child now, so she had to go through her interview process. So I work with Tara, so I'm delivering the presentation while she's being delivered another child. And I really want to thank the communities, because first we went into communities and said, do you think we're nuts? Because we really think health needs to be involved. And the reason for that is we usually see the more nightmare stories, like the school was built on a former munitions plant, and the community said, I don't care if it's clean, you didn't talk to us, and we are not sending our kids to school there. And boy, where does that development money go when you make a mistake like that? Or we come in to Kitty College in New Jersey that had been a mercury thermometer factory and somehow fell off the list. No remediation was done, and guess what it is? It's a daycare center for tots, little ones, and a pregnant owner. And we are trying to avoid these problems. And health departments, they end up getting involved whether they want to or not. So why not get involved at the beginning, when maybe you can stop having a problem that becomes the elephant under the rug? There's your learning objectives. We really want you to understand why health needs to be involved and how we have us as health professionals have a role in redevelopment. And we'd like you to be able to see some examples of how redevelopment has been influenced by health involvement early on. In terms of how we reach our goal, the CDC goal and public health goals of healthy communities, we want to emphasize health outcomes. We all want to be able to measure something as a measure of success when we have an intervention or a project. But what we're particularly concerned about is that most of us, I think, would agree that we view public health as really environmental justice. And the environment is the holistic environment. It's not just the contaminated properties. It's everything. It's the global environment. It's how we feel in our environment, how we function, what is our quality of life. And I think Anne has covered, and you'll hear from all of the speakers today, brownfields and land reuse sites. Land reuse sites to us is everything that isn't a brownfield. So it's the landfill down the road that's going to be reused, and they're putting in multi-million dollar homes in the middle of a chemical plant wasteland. Those are land reuse sites and brownfield sites to us. But what we know is that communities with a lot of brownfields, there's sort of a correlation or disproportionate amount of brownfields in disadvantaged communities. And I don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg, but we end up with a lot of health disparities in communities that have a lot of these sites. And it's not just environmental health disparities from exposures, it's quality of life, living with blight, etc. And we also know that as health professionals, we're uniquely qualified. I've had actually some very forward-thinking developers come up to me and say, you know, we should have worked with the health department because the community doesn't trust us. And the community doesn't necessarily trust the feds either, but they trust the local health department because that's where you go for your vaccines and that's where you go if your child has lead poisoning, etc. And our question that we didn't get to is, can we really measure changes? So when we set out to start this project a couple of years ago, we looked in the literature and we saw that in San Francisco they've been doing a health impact assessment and have come up with something called the Healthy Development Measurement Tool. And they're using HIA, Health Impact Assessment. And we looked at Health Impact Assessment and said, this is great. They're using this in Europe, and who really likes this? Who international? But how do communities use this? You need 2 days. I've taken the training. You need 2 days of training. And can I bring this into a community and say, you have to scope, and then you have to screen? And it's too difficult, I think, to be implemented at the community level. And it's not necessarily free, because sometimes you need the training, it's $1,000, you need a consultant. So what can we do that community members can do, that the Boys and Girls Club can get involved with, and the Girl Scouts? We also looked in Wisconsin. Wisconsin seems to light up the map for being very forward. I always say the Republicans are liberals in Wisconsin, because I worked there years ago, and I worked for the Republican caucus as a Democrat. And but we saw that in Menominee Valley, and just to give you an example, and this lights up the map if you do a Google search on Menominee Valley, they set out to measure changes in health through a cooperative project with the university and the 16th Street Community Health Center. And what that showed was they had 57 different benchmarks they wanted to look at. A little ambitious, but these are lessons learned, is that maybe 57 is a lot, and some of their measures were comparing air quality in one section against the city, so they ended up comparing their air quality against themselves and didn't look at things like windrows, which is why health professionals are also good at this, because I'm an environmental scientist, so this kind of work I've been a learning experience for me. I want to go measure things, so I'm learning to measure qualitative now. And I want to present two case examples so we can convince all of you that this really can work. Liz talked about the action model. I will fold a little bit of that in. We're really excited about that because the community feedback has been great, and it's so intuitive. It's so easy to use. But also, other people have done other things that we can learn from, and this is where we've had early involvement of health and where it's made a difference. Both of the communities were environmental justice communities, sort of lower income or blighted communities. One was in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and the other was in Clearwater, Florida. Kenosha had been a site with a former brass factory. I think it was called American Brass. So with brass foundry work, you have lots of metal contamination in the soil. It was quite blighted. The homes were in disrepair, a lot of renters versus home ownership. And the former mayor of Kenosha, John Antaramian, said, this is not how I see my community. I think he was the longest running mayor in Kenosha, and people love him. In fact, he's now become a consultant to Brownfields communities so that he can continue his good work. But he really said, we have to do something here. I don't like this. And this is what the site looked like before. He led a series of community meetings, his department, and said, what do you want? And we learned yesterday when someone presented about a site here, Jacobs.
Yeah. Village at Market Creek.
The village at Market Creek. People in the community said, oh, they asked us what we wanted. Wow, you know, they're listening to us. And then they did it. So he said, well, what do you want? And they said, you know, we really don't have a grocery store. The closest one is 2 miles away. Well, if you don't have a car, it's really hard to get to the grocery store. And sometimes buses are expensive. They're $2.25 here in San Diego. Same thing in Chicago. We also need homes we can afford. And we need another school. So he said, okay, I can do that. And he worked very closely with an environmental health specialist at the Department of Natural Resources, and he worked with the community. And we brought him in to speak at a roundtable, and we said, well, what did you do to improve public health? And he said, I didn't know it was public health. I was trying to improve the social fabric of my community. But that is public health. Mayor Antaramian is here.
Can't really see him.
He's a very friendly guy. He never wears a suit. And if you go to Kenosha, he'll drive you around in his van and show you all the things he's done in the city. And you could call him up and ask him to do that. This is the groundbreaking for the brass site, which we have done many times. What he did was very unique. He used tax increment financing and said, not only am I going to improve the brass site, we need to bring up the neighborhood around the site. So he was able to use the boundaries of tax increment financing and his Brownfields grants from EPA and other sources and go out in a 6-block radius around the site. So the site got developed last. Actually, it's still undergoing development. But he built these beautiful homes, they look southwestern, they're all different colors, and he said, we're going to sell these homes for $130,000. It actually cost the city $180,000 per home, but they're able to recoup the loss, the $50,000 loss on average, through creative financing. And at the Brass site, he put in a full-service grocery store before anything was developed, and it has a pharmacy and a bank. So you now have access to a way to bank, access to healthy foods, and you have access to a pharmacy so you can get your medications. He linked the site by trolley. It's a mile and a half from the more upper crust lakefront and the train station, and the trolley is 25 cents. So he wanted to make sure the community was linked to other areas. This is their transit map. It already had very good public transportation, but he's broadening a road so that there's now another road that links them to another shopping area that's walking distance. And the school is being built in the center of the Brass site, so they have a second school. His kids went to the school that's within the redevelopment area. And then they had a little problem with getting the metals out of the soil. They could dig to China and not get it clean enough. So he changed the design of the houses that are going to be right on that site to be row houses so they could bring people up above the soil a little bit. So this is what the center of the site looks like, and you can see that this full-service grocery store, pharmacy, and bank has been open while the site is still being built. And this has been a couple years. It's not been an easy road getting the actual site developed, and that's usually a developer issue. But they're moving forward, and this will be mixed-use housing. And this is a low- to moderate-income community. What we did when we were using the action model was to see if we could look at a community that was midway through redevelopment, and Kenosha seemed to be a perfect example, because we don't want to just say, oh, we've got this model, this is a four-step model, it's so easy and you can establish baseline. They already are very far along in redevelopment, but they collect data. Cities collect crime statistics, birth statistics, etc. So we were able to take the crime statistics that they gave us and show that they cut the crime rate in half. From this redevelopment, nothing changed. The demographics of the community didn't change. And they increased the average value of all property, essentially doubled property value. And he's working to keep taxes down, because as your property value goes up, your taxes go up. And we showed the reduction in crime. He increased the aesthetics of the neighborhood. It had a domino effect, like the opposite of the broken windows effect. People started planting flowers, and then their neighbors planted flowers. He met the needs of the community. We have access to education, full-service grocery store, healthy foods, and he did not gentrify the area. Now, people are finding this a very attractive area now and wanting to move in, but he's got his core there, and it will probably, like all places, gentrify somewhat. Another case study we have is in Clearwater, Florida. This was a huge brownfields area, 1,800 acres. It was once a center for the citrus industry, and like Milwaukee, had an exodus of businesses over the last 30 years. There were 220 potentially contaminated sites, former gas stations, dry cleaners, print shops. 10% of Clearwater residents live in this area, and 45% are minorities, 27% are in poverty. So another environmental justice community. The environmental specialist and brownfield specialist, Miles Balog, had a vision. He created an environmental justice plan and action agenda for this Clearwater area. He focused on community involvement, health concerns, and leveraged more funding through a Brownfields Assessment Grant, his original grant. He had an initial $100,000. It's not a lot of money, but it leveraged into, you know, tenfold, 10 million more in different types of funding. They've had 70 private sector projects in the area, 17 community projects, 1,000 new jobs, $250 million in capital investment, and redevelopment has improved health, environment, and the quality of life for residents. Here are some of the examples. The Willa Carson Clinic. Willa Carson was a public health nurse who was running, she was retired, she was running a clinic out of two apartments, so they were able to convert a former gas station into a clinic that now serves 7,000 community residents. It's a fully bilingual clinic, and it's fully funded. Another example, they had an abandoned gas station which became a neighborhood police station and family center. Revitalization of a junkyard. They restored a creek and now have a fire station. They took some dilapidated housing. You can see the before and after, and were able to take this blighted living quarters and make very nice homes for people there, and it spurred some neighborhood redevelopment and renaissance. So in conclusion, we feel very strongly that health professionals and communities have a very clear role in redevelopment and can influence redevelopment. Having this early focus on health in the redevelopment plan can improve the overall health status of communities, and we're starting to be able to measure that, looking at things that are already measured. Some of the case examples suggest we can measure these changes, as I've just said, and I also want to thank Kenosha and Clearwater for providing some of the photos that we've used in this. And we'll take questions later, but this is my contact information, especially if you're interested in learning about the site inventory tool or the action model.
You can see why she's a national gem for ATSTR. So next, I'd like to, now there's been some mention of all the communities that have had different kind of brownfield grants, and I didn't talk about that. So it isn't too late if you're interested in applying for grant funds. One, you can apply for an assessment grant, which is $200,000, and it's to either do community-wide, so you can identify potential brownfields in your area, or you can actually get a site-specific also for $200,000. There are cleanup grants, but you have to own the site. And then, thank you. And then there's another fund that